to be a support your view that it's cruel.
Oh, well, I think it would be something inevitable if you're an intruder on the family.
You start from the outside in, don't you?
Well,
as you say, you're terrified.
Oliver, really, insofar as it's relevant to her career, you see, we can move on from her parents to Rare's wife and mother, which was the next thing we sort of started to talk about. Could you just tell me what Oliver was like, really? Yeah.
Not an awful easy thing to say about one's father.
I mean, he was
a charmer. He was a total charmer. And, I mean, he rather banked on that to some extent. I mean, he coasted a bit through life through being a charmer. He was lazy. He was rather without fortitude, if you know what I mean. I mean, he wasn't a man of great grit. He was, however, very highly intelligent. More highly intelligent than he ever expressed, because he was so lazy. He was very interested in philosophy, metaphysics, argument of all sorts and kinds, and music. He was desperately interested in music. But he was a bit of a dilettante in life altogether. He happened to find, rather late, a profession he liked. His first job was in India, which he hated, loathed, and disliked very much. And having got rid of the marriage he'd made rashly there and come back to England, he had no job at all. He wasn't very well. And he married Ray. Hadn't got a job at all in those days. And he was supposed to do the housekeeping and she was supposed to do the work. But he had really no gift for housekeeping either. He used to order a new leg of mutton and a new rice pudding every day. And what happened to the last one was not really anything that he was interested in, so she took over both.
So he, in a sense, they're complementary to each other to some extent in their qualities, aren't they? She's the practical person.
Well, I mean, yes, they were different. They were very different. On the other hand, they both passionately believed that people's personal independence was the most important thing and that to interfere with somebody else was the ultimate and absolute crime. And this, I think, was what they both continued to enjoy throughout their life. And to respect and to like in each other and to miss when they didn't find it. This they both really gloried in. They contrived to go on enjoying that in a way which might have drifted apart but didn't. And this was nice, it was very nice because they were very rarely seen together. Oliver used to go out to a large social life, I mean a lot of social life, and Ray didn't. So that they were never seen together to all intents and purposes. And every now and then Oliver would have no evening out. He wasn't one to say what he was doing in advance, but he would suddenly find himself without an evening out. And he would spend an evening at home. And then the delight with which, quite late, I mean, when I was already grown up, the delight with which they would both suddenly realize they were both there was really very pleasing. They got on very well. And then I can remember there was one perfectly ridiculous, now I don't quote this, but it's very nice. There was the flood, the great flood of 1929.
Oh, yes, yes.
Took place in the house. Ray was away, but Oliver was there. And I was in Vienna at the time, but he was there. And the police came down the street and knocked on all the doors saying, archaically, the Thames is out, the Thames is out. And it flooded the basement for 18 inches. We were on one of those streets where it really flooded right up. And Oliver contrived to move most of it up. And we had mushrooms growing in the dining room for a long time, so that Ray used to say to anybody who came to dinner, will you have a sweet or, and she pointed to the corner, the savoury. However, it rather rotted the foundations of the house to some extent.
The house was where at that time?
It was in Marsham Street.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it had a bathroom on the ground floor out at the back. And Ray was in the habit of sitting where there is seating space, usually in a bathroom, while Oliver had a bath, talking to him, reading the paper. And on one never-to-be-forgotten occasion, the whole contraption fell through on the floor by 18 inches. Oliver in the bath, and Ray sitting. absolutely enormous.
Yes.
And so was ours, I may say.
But why Marshall Street, actually? Because that was the place where the London Society...
Well, indeed, that's why she moved.
That is why she moved there.
They had lived in Gordon Square for a long time, and they finally moved out of Gordon Square deliberately to go into Westminster, be near it. She nearly took a house called a Farm Westminster, which would have been really rather nice. But it had snags attached. She lived in three different houses in Marsham Street.
Did she really? And the magnet in that case was the...
She lived over it at one stage at 35. And she lived at 53 and she lived at 73. We did.
So when she was in London, presumably she was in and out of Service House all the time. And in fact could be called upon easily for any sort of emergency if she was at home and vice versa.
Indeed, we lived above it at one stage.
Was there a community of feminists, so to speak, round about, would you say? I mean, was Eleanor Rathbone nearby, or Eva Hubbard?
I didn't know about that, you see. I mean, I wasn't really mixed into that part of her life at all. I mean, all the fascinating equal women that haunted 35 were around, and I mean, they were likely to turn up. There was one pluperfect equal woman who was called Miss Ward. I don't know whether you've come across
her. Helen Ward, is that?
I suppose so. I mean, she was cubical, not only equal, but cubical.
Well, we had one.
She was a dear. On one side.
So anyway, they had that sort of partnership of independence, in a sense, the two of them. And that means that Ray's landed with really bringing you two up.
Oh, yes. He didn't have anything to do with it. He didn't like children. The only thing he did about bringing me up was when I was 9, he decided it was high time I learned to play bridge. So he and Ray and I played a three-handed game of bridge, my first. And at the end of it, he proceeded to a post-mortem, halfway through which I fled in tears, and he looked at Ray and said, "What's the matter with the child?" That was his idea of bringing one up.
Yes. So she, getting on to what she was like as a mother, I mean, you spoke very highly of her, really, in a number of ways.
She's a wonderful mother.
When you say she's a wonderful mother, for what?
Well, for first place, for total responsibility. You knew you could rely on her for anything. And that involved coming out to Switzerland when I called on her when I was at school, whatever she was doing, and rescuing me from situations I might get into. It was in always being there to complain to write about, to answer questions, to help one, she was always at the back there. And questions were by no means the only thing. She always seemed to know the answer. And if on any occasion she by any chance didn't know the answer, she would help one to look it up. And she taught one the habit of looking things up, which was not a bad thing to do either. And I can remember once when she used to take us down to the country for the weekend in the car, and it was about an hour and a half, hour and three quarters trip. And this was regarded by us, because she used to take us separately, quite deliberately, so that we each had a go at her. We used to sit beside her, talk for the whole of that, or listen for the whole of that period, and ask her questions. And Christopher, who was a very precocious brat, settled down one weekend and said, "Now, Ray," they used to call our parents by their Christian names, and he said, "Now, Ray," I suppose he was about 11, "I would like you to tell me the causes of the Great War." Both must have been 27 at the time, I mean 1927. So Ray struggled through the causes of the Great War. "Thank you," said he, "now let's have the history of the Great War." And when she got through that lot, he said, "Now let's have the results." Tough.
But she did it, she encouraged you to learn by the Socratic method, really, in a way, getting you to ask questions.
And if necessary, looking it up in encyclopedias. Or history books or whatever, yes. I mean, she didn't know the answer. She told us, quite frankly. No, I mean, quite possibly she didn't know all the results of the Great War. But she'd recommend us what to read. Very useful.
So she put it in that way. But there are other ways in which she's good, aren't there? I mean, what about, for instance, joining in things with you as children? Didn't she? I mean, wasn't one of the great things that Mrs. Dunlop said this afternoon, her recollections of the mud house, was that all sorts of things.
decided to marry. That depends on what you want to do. There was always something going on. The grown-ups had fun. The grown-ups played. This was what you mean, I think. And the grown-ups played just as much as the children. And it was not regarded as a very considerable difference that you were a generation older. You just enjoyed yourself in much the same way. If you wanted to go picking or driving or building or swimming or whatever it was you did, the children and the grown-ups did it immaterially together. That was also very nice.
Related there is the fact that she's what they call a physical person. Yep. She swims, she walks, picks berries low down on the ground.
That's picking was her greatest pleasure, mushrooms or bilberries or whatever it might be. She adored going out to pick. I couldn't see that.
And she's generally an outdoor person.
She's an outdoor person.
Yes.
Now, I was not, so that I didn't join her as much as Christopher did.
Yes.
But if you wanted to, it was always there to be done.
So she has that attraction for you. I've been looking at it so rather coldly. but also, of course, she was very good.
Yes, she was very. Mind you, we were so affectionate that most of her affection was devoted to fending us off physically, because, I mean, we were all over her all the time. But she was very good fun to be with. She was always answered our questions honestly and frankly and usefully. And boy, there were lots. And she was safe. She was totally safe. And she was always there when we wanted her.
She came within 48 hours out to you in Switzerland.
Yeah, yeah. I had a ridiculous problem out there. And as we were, our letters home were read, which was a very strict school. It was a good school, but it was very strict. And I made the arrangement with her in advance that I would put P.S. many happy returns, which is not a thing one would normally do, if I was in real despair or distress, because I didn't wish to write about it. And I did this because we'd all got into a tiz about being adopted. Quite silly. I mean, it's one of those things that happen when you're a child. And within 48 hours, she was out there. And she solved it within half an hour, too. No, she was a very good mother indeed, I think.
And then there's that splendid incident in California, which I think we've got, haven't we? Where she sends the money straight away without asking a single question.
Yes. No, you knew perfectly well that you would never get into trouble if she was anywhere in the offing. Yes. And there was anything humanly possible to be done, she'd do it.
Sounds to me, actually, Mrs. Hammond, as if she's a bit like what a lot of people have said of Eva Hummock to me. That is, somebody said of Eva to me, when she died, I felt I'd lost my protector. Mm. That is, she's one of those people who props the world up.
Yeah. Oh, yes, we talked of Ray as the rock. Now, when Ray died, she was only 53, and I was, 28, I suppose, at the time. And Christopher was only 24. And it was a terrible shock to everybody concerned, because nobody expects a woman of 53 to die like that suddenly, very suddenly. And she was deeply involved in all sorts of things, and all sorts of activities, and all sorts of people. And Christopher and I, quite deliberately, as much as a sort of therapy for ourselves as anything else, divided up all these activities and people between us and deliberately went around winding them up one after another, because we felt that, in a sense, it was our duty to do. In another, it was, as I say, it was curative to us to do. And for a third thing, they jolly well needed it. One of the most destroyed was Lady Astor. She was really in a very low state. She really minded a lot. And all these people felt, you see, that Ray's energy and drive and ability and openness and fun was one of the things which had pushed them along on their own life. And when it had gone, they were really very stuck. And for instance, her Women's Employment Federation proposed on paper to wind itself up because there wasn't anybody else who could carry it on. And as my part of the job, I regarded this as my duty, being her daughter, to write, and I wrote, I suppose, about 40 letters to different people saying this is the last thing she would want. And it did, in fact, carry on. And I hope that was that had something to do with it, but I mean, they needed doing.
Yes, one thing I did want to ask you, Mrs. Halpern, was about, is it Irene Hilton who took over? Is she alive now? I mean,
no, you see.
Yes.
I think Dewey would be the only one who took
over. Well, I asked her, and I haven't had a letter from her yet. I just wonder whether you knew, in fact, whether she was still.
In many, many years since I've seen her.
But she was the person who, in fact, stood to your mother.
Well, she inherited it.
Yes.
They had to have somebody. No, actually, I think who inherited it was some general's daughter. I've forgotten her name now. But that was temporary. I think Irene Hilton was the first paid one. Because she died in the war, you see, and the war was not wholly typical.
So the only other thing we talked about last time, which really is rather important, is the fact that as a negative virtue of her as a mother, that you never really felt that her public activities competed with you.
No.
And the reason for that was?
Well, I would say the reason for that was that one of the things she had absorbed willingly and happily and completely from her grandmother was that the most important thing you could do was to bring up children. And this, she had absorbed it, but her sister had not. And her sister was always away on her own career, leaving her two children stuck, and really just passed them over to Ray to deal with. Ray resented it from time to time, but she always dealt. You couldn't leave anybody within reach of her in a spot without her rescuing them. But she may have complained every now and then, but she could be relied on to rescue them. And she rescued not only Karin's two children, but also her Oliver's brother's three children with Pippa.
And Julia, well, she was trying with Julia, wouldn't she? But Julia was too difficult. Anyway, wasn't she?
Julia was too difficult. She was 11 years old when Ray married. 10 years old when Ray married, and she resented Ray, of course, very much. And she was a very difficult child with a very difficult history herself. She batted around from pillar to post, and unhappy and spoilt and difficult and impossible around the house. And Ray couldn't cope with her at all.
But tried.
She tried, yes. But she didn't, I think, feel safe. There was no actual physical bond or relationship, and I think bond of relationship to the Oliver's nephews and nieces was a mental one. She'd been extremely fond of their father, very fond of their father, and he died. And when he died, she felt a duty to them. She didn't, in odd kind of way, she didn't feel the same duty to him.
The fact that she was able to reconcile these roles, if you like to put it that way, is a partly attributable fact that you went to boarding school.
Well, she planned it very carefully, yes. I mean, she was capable of looking ahead and seeing where the difficulties were going to occur and taking steps to avoid them. For one thing, she was very strongly of the opinion that Bloomsbury was no kind of a place to bring children up in. She moved out of Gordon's.
You mean the location?
The spiritual location.
I see.
But as
I actually, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
she thought it was, I think, possible to say that the thing she thought was most dangerous, particularly for me, perhaps less so for my brother, was glamour. And she thought that I would get glamorized, as it were. I would get attracted into a hectic, unreal excitement by the goings-on, which were very exciting there, and that I would lose my sense of proportion entirely, and lose my sense of balance, and lose my sense, and lose the work, any work I might be doing. It would be very bad for me. And I think possibly right, because I was a very unwise child. Christopher, I think, was less likely to be upset, but he was very nervous and difficult. She said, again, she didn't think it was very good for him. And therefore, this is one of the reasons, apart from where the women's service was, with her moving out of Bloomsbury as we began to get adolescent, as I got to be 13, 14, or whatever it was, she thought it was highly desirable to get me out of the area, so that I could drop in on a party that was going on next door. So I didn't really see much of them until I was, when I was 18, she said, well, now it's up to you, you can do what you like, go to a party if you want to, but from 14 to 18, she thought it was better for me to be out of the way.
So it's not just that she wants to have time free, so to speak, to get on with her public career.
Oh, no, she planned out.
It's the other way around, really.
I mean, she planned her career around her children. She carefully, I mean, she spent a terrible lot of time finding suitable schools for us. And when I got into difficulties at 15, when I got too precocious and difficult, she spent a great deal of time and trouble in finding the right kind of place. And without me being aware that the effort was spent, you see, so that I thought this was just the natural thing that was happening. But she thought about it a great deal and spent a lot of time and trouble and money on it.
Yes, and the other side of
I think it's possible to put it that way. She would take quite a lot of trouble to get relieved from it. And I think myself that if she'd lived today and not then, she would have found some other way of getting rid of the chores. I mean, I think that the fact that service was available then meant that service was the way in which she got rid of the chores. I don't think that if we lived nowadays, we would have lived as comfortably as we did then. Not that we always lived comfortably, because she had no idea of congenial surroundings from an artistic point of view, but she did believe in good food. So as we always had that. Now, I believe it's possible that if she'd been alive today, functioning, we wouldn't even have had good food. But I still think she would have organized it so that she was able to give her time to us, because I think she considered that the most important thing in the world.
And so when she was writing or preparing a memorandum or whatever it might be, you weren't particularly shut out of her life if it happened to coincide with your being at home. There would be just an unspoken agreement with
Yes, she would. We go out and do something else.
But she wasn't, in a sense, obsessive about...
Not at all. I mean, we'd obviously notice that part of the time she was working.
Yes.
But, I mean, we wouldn't feel aggrieved at all.
There wasn't a competition, in a sense. And as far as actually managing the household, it's happened very competent, presumably, very able at organising the finances,
I wouldn't say that from that. Her control of finances was deplorable, absolutely deplorable. She was always running into debt one way or another. She was practical in the sense that she got the things she regarded as important done. But the things she regarded important were not what would normally be regarded as those which a good manager would manage. She was not concerned at all with how her household looked. It could get pretty filthy before she'd notice. And the mendings would not occur at the right time, and the clothes would all be in a frightful condition. She was always going out to very, very grand parties with her evening dress on inside out, and she never noticed, nor could she believe that it was worth going home to change it when somebody pointed it out. I mean, she had very little sense of what's called the feminine side of life at all.
Did she also go to a garden party or something?
No, it was an evening party.
Didn't she wear the wrong shoe or something? I was mistaken.
There's probably something in the biography which I've forgotten. But I myself remember her coming downstairs to go to a party at Lady Astor's. And she'd got an evening dress from her mother. She would never have bought such a thing herself. But Mary had given her a very grand evening dress made of superb brocade. It was white brocade with gold ears of corn about a foot high on it. It was very lovely material. She got this thing on inside out, and she came downstairs of our house, and I was about 15. And I stopped her, and I said, "You've got that on inside out, Ray." She said, "Doesn't matter. Nobody will notice."
And she could, in fact, look rather nice if she did take the trouble.
She was always fat, of course. But she really not only didn't mind, but she resented paying any attention to her appearance. Oh, she really, really disliked. She didn't only not like it, she disliked it.
And that would carry over into makeup as well.
Oh, my God, yes. And it would carry on out into furnishing as well. Because on one occasion, when my cousin Ursula and I were about 17, 18, we thought we'd make the house in the country look nicer. And we painted a small bedroom, which I used to sleep in, green. And we bought, with our own money, we bought a bedspread and a little mat, sort of bath mat style, and little gingham curtains. We made it look quite nice, green and white. Then we went back to our respective colleges. When we came back for the next holidays, the curtains were in one room, bedspread was in another. She wouldn't have it. She just wouldn't have it. And I believe that was half conscious. I mean, I don't think it was entirely accidental.
Could you just clarify the role of mud in her life? It's simply an escape. It's a place where she could completely relax.
It was her home, her house. It was partly based on her own childhood, because it was within sight of the place where she lived all as a child. It was her house, not Oliver's. Oliver came there as a guest very often, but it was her house. It was where she was in charge of the way in which things happened and the way in which they were done. And it was the way in which she was private. She used to absent herself when anybody came to call. She wouldn't mix herself. herself in locally. And she built herself a swimming pool practically before the house was finished. Two characters committed suicide in it once more. There's only water in the neighborhood.
And what would she wear? Just wear anything there, would she?
Well, sometimes she wore, in the summer, sometimes she wore really what amounted to a smock, a cotton frock, some of which she made herself with stitches so large they were all coming apart at the seams. But for the most time, she wore Landau costume, that's to say, khaki, cotton,
denim.
What sort of denim? It wasn't as heavy as denim, it was lighter than denim, but it was khaki in colour, and it was a sort of breeches. She started by wearing Land Army boots, but they got a bit heavy, so she wore ordinary stockings and shoes underneath those. But breeches, knee breeches, they were a marvellous sight. She was a huge woman. And then a sort of a smock blouse on top of that, and the coat that went with it on top of that when it was chilly, and a very, very rudimentary straw hat.
How was she regarded locally? I mean, wasn't there any view of her? Was she regarded as eccentric?
Yes, she was obviously eccentric, but they didn't have much sight of her because the minute they came in sight, she locked herself in the loo. So there wasn't much hope for their seeing what she looked like. But the gardeners and the store people and everybody, they just regarded her as an entertainment. They liked her very much, and she was always helpful to them. I mean, she wasn't unfriendly at all. Because any of the social kinds, she was unfriendly to. She got on extremely well with the gardeners and so forth.
Yes, I was really wondering, was she good at organising sort of teams of people to do things for her? And that is, gardeners or cleaners or whatever it might be. Was she good at, in a sense, delegating?
She was too good at delegating. That's to say, she found somebody whom she more or less trusted, and then she left it entirely to them because she couldn't be bothered. She had a super cook there, who was really the housekeeper cook. She didn't do any of the ordering. I mean, the cook did everything. She worked the whole thing. And Ray just told her, either rang her up or sent her a postcard up when she was coming down. And that was it, you see. But you have to find her in the first place. But once found, that was all the world. She was an appalling woman in some ways, but Ray wouldn't dream of getting rid of her because then she would have had to have tried all over again.
Did she do what I think Eva Herbert did? That is, did she enter into other people's problems very easily and help them at whatever social level? I mean, the people she was working for and so on, and attract their loyalty in that way as well.
She'd resist as long as she could. I mean, she wouldn't do it at all easily. She wouldn't welcome it. But if it came her way, she would be the rock on which you would finally rescue yourself. But she would rather resent people coming to her unless they were in a real state of despair and had to. And when you had to do it, she did.
Unless they were family aware, they didn't need to come to her.
No, she was there. But outside people, she would complain if they came to her, certainly. But she would do it.
Yes, yes. About building mud, I mean, she built it in this sort of mud.
Pied de terre, it's called.
Yes,
and
yes.
It's supposed to be round earth, and there's only one sort of an earth which takes to it. If it's too clay, it cracks. If it's too sandy, it falls down. And she didn't know this when she started doing it, but by the mercy of Providence, the bit she dug out of the foundations to put into the walls was the right kind. But you can't do it everywhere because it's not... you have to have the right soil.
And her building enterprise really failed because the right soil is not...
Partly because of that, I think, and partly because of very considerable union resentment, because you don't need skilled bricklayers to build a house, and was therefore... She learned an awful lot about union behaviour after that lot.
Yes, yes. As far as the family is concerned, will you, when she's there, in the holidays, you're there, presumably, are you? She takes the children with her whenever she goes there.
Well, she'd go there in the term as well. See, I'd come back for the holidays and then she'd be there. Or she might go up to town in the middle of the week and come down again. We usually have, there'd always be the housekeeper, you see, to look after us. And there'd usually be a nurse or somebody around too when we were young. And, or we might go up with her. It depended on the way it was. But if my brother went to a weekend school, boarding school, which you came home for weekends because she felt you needed to be eased into boarding school life. But he chose one within 2 or 3 miles of Mud, and she drove him up and down and took him across to Mud. So he was there during the term as well. She kept us apart because we quarrelled.
But it's presumably, quite this way, and I'm probably getting this wrong, but does she find the sort of London-based political career that she has in some ways very sort of, it bottles her up? I mean, she's not able to be natural and free and so on. This is another part of her dislike of sort of artificialities of society, really. And that she just must have a place where all this can be unbuttoned.
I think that's true. I think that's true. I think she would have been very unhappy if she'd ever had, by any conceivable chance, a resident job. I think this would probably have upset her if she'd ever been the principal of Newnham, which she thought to be at one stage. I think she would have found it very impressive from a hospitality point of view. Except, of course, the vacations are long enough for her to have a hell of a whoop. But she did not like a conventional social life at all.
I think you must have some water.
To be really revealing on paper.
Yes.
But I'd like you to tell me what Mary told you.
Yes. You see, Mary didn't say very much because she just talked a little bit about what Pippa was like as a person, how she liked her in conversations, I remember. And that laugh that Strachey's have.
Everything was on an in-breath.
I see.
Great old hawking crow.
And they'd all do it.
Yes. And when you've got 6 or 8 of them together, it's really quite...
They must have been quite daunting to come among.
Oh, God, yes. Not to me, but I mean, they wouldn't be to announce. But they weren't least daunting to me.
Although you did, they were daunting in the sense that you wanted to react against them, didn't you?
That's not exactly it. They weren't daunting. I reacted against them, but I wasn't the least frightened of doing that. I'd argue outright with them, you see. I mean, if you're daunting, you would have kept it to yourself.
Yes, perhaps daunting is the wrong word, but anyway, I think you as you put it last time, I think you felt that there was something lacking in their intellectualism, that is,
yes. Yes, but I distinguo, so to speak. There are two experiences of them that you'd have. There are the experience of a social evening. Nobody would bother about their intellectualism on social evening. You would enjoy it. And you'd play games, you'd talk, you'd laugh, you'd discuss things, you'd start arguments. And nobody's bothered about whether you're too intellectual on that, you're too deep in it. I mean, this is just fun. And that was not daunting, of course, in the least. I mean, they were in. Belonged. It was when you withdrew a bit that you began to disagree with them, and then of course they weren't there daunting because they weren't there to that extent. I mean, just occasionally you revolted at them when they were there individually. You couldn't do that when there was a group of them because it was too social. But I did have one major quarrel, as it were, with Virginia about it. I was quite grown up then. I can't remember what I said, what she said. I can remember what I said.
But Virginia herself used to go down to the Mud House.
Yeah, that was at the Mud House.
How did she cope with the Mud House, actually? Did she fit into this rather sort of natural atmosphere?
Oh, yes. I mean, all the Bloomsbury found that perfectly natural. They weren't bothered about it.
And they're not sort of aesthetes, all sort of precious urban people, exactly.
No, they were all, I mean, none of them paid very much attention to the conventions of any sort.
And they don't sort of insist on lavish comforts? Or
but they hadn't, no. None of their houses had them. But, they were all very peculiar. In fact, the major sort of mother house of Gordon Square in Bloomsbury, which was the Strachey house there, it was like the fall of the House of Usher. It was the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen. Wallpaper was peeling off the walls, and all the chairs were held up. One leg was held up by a pile of very aged books instead of one leg. And all the springs were so far out of the seat, when you got up, the chair came with you. It was
most extraordinary house I've ever seen.
And there was piles and piles and piles of pictures piled against the walls wherever you went. And somebody bought somebody or other's library intact some 120 years ago, and it was all there with mouldering leather backs on one set of bookcases. What the most extraordinary house. And then Pippa was sitting in one corner with piles of correspondence from the office from 1920 behind her. This was somewhere around 1950. She got about 30 years behind.
Oh, it was a wonderful house.
We didn't talk much about your mother's paperwork this time. I mean, she was quite well organized as far as that.
Oh, no, she was. And I mean, when it came to that, so was Pippa, really. I mean, we mocked her that it was 30 years behind, but it wasn't really. But she had a lot of things that she liked to know. She got blind in the end. And finally, she had to be moved into a nursing home because it wasn't possible to look after her. And the house they'd lived in, for goodness knows how many tens of years, and of course, like every house, it got full of bits and pieces. And Pippa was very pernickety. I've seen her cut a pea into four pieces and put each piece separately in her mouth. Literally, it's perfectly true. And when she came to move out, blind as she was, you see, she couldn't look through all the drawers. So she had to get various people to do it for her. And this was a really agonizing performance, because she would sit in the room and she would say, "Now, in those drawers, will you go through them all?" She would say slowly, "and I'll tell you whether they should be kept or not." So you took out the drawer, you began to go through the pieces of paper within it, and you came across a copy of New Statesman for 1903, as it might be. So you said, "Can I throw this out?" "Ah, no," she said. "Before you throw it out, you must read through the index to see whether there's any reason why we kept it." Imagine.
Get very far.
You also had a story about how difficult she was towards the end of her life if you wanted to make her have a sensible bank, for instance.
Yeah, well, she got, this I suppose everybody does when they get older, I hope not, but it's very likely. And she'd got, she was up from over 90 when she died, 94. And she had a bank somewhere in the city. And we all thought it would be so much easier because she had to go along in a taxi or send somebody in a taxi to collect the money from this bank because it had no branch anywhere near, you see. And we all thought it would be so much easier for her to change to a bank near at hand, but she wouldn't dream of it. She wouldn't dream of it, no. And when she disagreed with you over something you were trying to suggest she should do, there would be a long silence. And then she changed the subject.
And there's just nothing you could do with her,
whatever.
We did also talk a bit, I think, actually, Mrs. Halpin, about what she was like in company. She was quite a reticent person, generally, wasn't she? But in strangey company, then she would...
Oh, she'd come out in strangey company, all right. Oh, yes, she was as entertaining as the rest of them. Not as loud, but she was fully as entertaining. She was a terribly sympathetic person. In that she would, I dare say Mary told her this too, that she was a person to whom anybody could, she was desperately interested in anything about you. And if you, she was very affectionate, and she loved her family, and she loved the people who were her close circle, whether they were family or not. And if there was anything that they were doing that was new, if you had a new job, or if you had a new house, or if anything was happening to you, she would listen, she would hang on your words, she would listen to it with immense interest, which is terribly, terribly nice in somebody. I mean, her interest in other people was absolutely unending.
And there was a family story, wasn't there, about her?
About her peers. She, as a result of all this, of course, everybody told her the story of their life. And Ray was always mocking her with the fact that she couldn't come anywhere near anybody without their telling her the story of her life. And the story was that on one occasion she and Ray were travelling by train in a deep fog. And in fact, the train was stopped at one station because the fog got so deep. And so they started walking up and down the platform until the fog lifted. And in the course of this walk, they passed the cab of the engine, just barely visible through the fog. And according to the story, the engine driver leant out of the cab and started telling the story of his life.
It was the story.
And to look at, she was not any more attractive than any of the other strangers, really. Not her.
No, she was rather spiderish. She was small with sort of black eyes, small eyes, all strange. She's got big eyes. She was not particularly beautiful at all, never had been. And of course, no particular attention to her appearance either. They none of them had that either. No, they were not beauties.
But this is absolutely central, you see, to my interest. The relationship between her and your mother is crucial, really, in the whole running of the...
Well, this is something that would not have appeared in that book, because the two sisters, both Dorothy and Pippa, were my mother's dearest friends for almost all her life. And I mean, if I say that she was fonder of them than she was of Oliver, this is, of course, not in one sense true. But in one sense it is, because Oliver did not enter into her daily life and her work and everything else. And Pippa certainly did. Dorothy, she used to stay with him in South France very, very often as a holiday, as a relief, as a personal. But Pippa was, in a sense, she was more married to Pippa than she was to Oliver. And they're very, very dearly fond of each other, both of them.
And when together, how would they, who would do the talking, who would be the...
I was never there when they were alone together, mm-hmm. I tell you, nor when they ever talked work. And I knew this only insofar as Pippa was almost always there, but Pippa was not a great talker. And of course we, as children, usually very firmly interrupted whatever it was that they were doing and were not therefore really well aware of what was going on. We were more interested in our own film.
One small thing about her upbringing, obviously, she wasn't in a sense, quote, progressive in her upbringing of children, was she, in the sense that she shared a pretty widespread view at that time that children must be kept in order. She's a sort of mixture, isn't she, of progressivism and Victorianism, as we'd see it now.
She was not an ismist. Mm. And I think also she'd been, her own upbringing had been by the grandmother who believed that the one thing that children really needed was to have fun. And that if they were happy, they were good. And this, if this is progressive, then she'd been brought up progressively and just tried to pass it on. And I think she gave probably too little discipline, if anything, as indeed I think she'd had too little herself. I think we were both, to some extent, spoiled.
But there weren't sort of moral pressures or punishments or things like that in the air very much.
I've only once in my life did I see her lose her temper. Only once. And that was so horrifying. I mean, losing one's temper was regarded as shameful, almost an illness. It was disgraceful, really. One did not lose one's temper. It was the last thing that ever happened. And she didn't lose her temper. I used to lose my temper regularly with Christopher. And this got her irritated sometimes because we lost our tempers. But she herself only did it once.
And one doesn't lose one's temper. Why? Because one should sort things out rationally. Or because this is just not done socially, or what? Presumably a mixture of the two in a way, isn't it?
I suppose. I don't think you can pinpoint it. It's just not the way to behave. Mm. It's neither sensible, nor kind, nor does it get you anywhere. Mm. And it, in fact, is very painful to oneself. At least this is the impression I'm left with, which I imagine is what she felt, because I echo it.
Yes, and there is a certain, I think this is what Sanders says in his thing on the straight, maybe it's reflected in your mother as well, there just is a feeling that emotion is something that's supposed to be contained and kept under the surface. Is that wrong?
She once wrote to me, when I was about 17, and I did quite a lot of writing to her, she wrote to me that emotion is like onions in a salad. A little of it rubbed round the bowl flavours the lot too much and it ruins it. I disagree.
But
I think she was too afraid of emotion.
Yes, and is that a generally Strachey characteristic as well, although of course she had it for other reasons and found it again in the Stracheys, is that right?
I can't tell you. This is too difficult. Mm. I think they were different from her. same spot from a different angle.
Yes, yes.
That's as near as I can get to it.
Yes, yes.
Their reasons for distrusting emotion are not the same.
Yes. But anyway, one could say, could one, that the London Society was run by your mother and Pippa as part of an outcrop of their personal relationship.
Or, equally, you could turn it upside down and say that the reason why they became so intimate was that they had the same aims, activities and occupations and professional, and that they fitted so well in their profession. I mean, I think both are true.
Yes.
You can't say one is truer than the other. I think they fit in.
There's no
perfect partnership.
There's no other relationship with other women prominent in the feminist movement. I know this isn't your favourite area. To compare with that.
No, nothing to compare with that. The nearest thing was Molly. She made very, very good friends with Molly.
Yes, what is, we didn't really talk about Molly last time. I mean, the connection there is, I suppose, League of Nations, isn't it? And,
yes, I think you just happened to come across, and one does, after all, mercifully all through life, one comes across people and finds immensely congenial and makes friends with them. There's not a thing that stops in early youth. And I think she came across Molly, and they found simply that they were immensely congenial, as a result of which she used to go on holiday. She went to Greece with her, she went to South France with her, she used to come to Mount very frequently. They just got on terribly well. And the fact that Molly was, in fact, a political person as well, again, you see, I think with Ray it was rather necessary, if you were going to be really intimate with her, to approve of her activities and join to some extent in Molly, of course, did.
But they presumably have affinities which I suppose you must have found it difficult to understand because you didn't like Molly yourself.
I didn't dislike her that much. I found her a bit, she grated a bit. I was possibly jealous, God knows.
She's not a prominent person in the women's movement particularly. She's prominent in the labour world, not the women's movement.
Yes, but I mean the world was sufficiently similar. The world of committees, of political meetings, whatever you call it, of lobbying, of all that. I mean, she was familiar with the terminology and the
technique. Yes, she would be, yes.
It was not so far off. It wasn't as though she was an artist or something quite different.
Yes, yes. Yes, because that really is extremely helpful, because you see, it's the sort of thing one could read annual report after annual report of the LSWS, and you just would never get at that. Really.
She was very fond of seeing a Clough, too.
Was she?
But, of course, she was a lot older. She admired Thina. I mean, Thina was, as it were, in a kind of a serial mother figure to her in some way. She really admired Thina immensely.
You don't remember anything, I suppose, about, I think this is something we did talk about in a way, about the actual writing of the cause, do you, really? I suppose you were really quite young then, weren't you?
Yes, I don't remember that as distinct from it. She was always writing something, you see. I mean, she used to write endless articles and endless broadcast talks, and what she was writing, of course, was not, I mean, we used sometimes to read it, we were sometimes not madly interested in the contents, except when there were broadcast talks, and those were rather more fun because they were more human than the other
ones. Yes.
The cause I did find interesting, yes. In fact, at one stage I conducted a series of lectures on it, but she was dead by then, so she didn't know. But I was, I found that much more readable than anywhere else.
Yes, well, I think so.
But it's also readable. And I think this to some extent is because enthusiasm ran away with her. I think her literary style was too mannered, it was too controlled, it was too reduced to words of one syllable sort of sense. You know, I mean, she deliberately made it over simple, with the result that it rather sounded as though it was a reading book with the hyphens between the syllables, you know. But in the cause, she ran away with her a bit, and she let herself rip, and the result was that it reads much more genuine.
Was she a good talker or a public speaker?
Yes, I think she was very good. I think she was very good. She was funny, she was driving, and she was also exceedingly sensible. And I think she was really a first-class speaker.
With control of her points.
Oh, yes, oh, yes. I mean, again, I was not in a profession to judge, and in a position to judge it professionally as I would be now. But from every impression I got from everybody else and from so such listening to her as I remember. She was really very interesting to speak of.
Oh, she's clearly very successful. This was one of the things we did discuss last time, I think, was simply how far she was conscious of her own success or reputation or whatever, i.e. the letters to her
mother. She was always bursting about that, yes.
But that was a family characteristic, I think.
Well, as I say, yes, I mean, I think one of the things we did was well, it's rather like Storky, I gloat, you know, I mean, one did gloat. And one felt that within the family, one was in a position to say to each other, look how good I've been, you see, and I mean, this was fun.
In a way, the family performed the same sort of function in her life as the Mudhouse does, that is, she can relax completely and say whatever she likes. In a sense, it's presumably the outcrop or the...
You have to be modest in public, yes, you have to be modest
in public. Modesty in public, yes.
I mean, that we carried on too. Brother and I used to say the same sort of things.
Yeah, so family life is really, in many ways, very important to the successfulness of a public career.
Oh, I should have thought so, yes.
I mean, without it, she couldn't possibly have stood the strain of all the others could.
She had a curious married life. I mean, I wouldn't have said that on pattern her married life was the thing which was most successful about her private life. It was not manifestly unsuccessful, but it was... atypical of married lives, if you know what I mean, because it was a bit lopsided. And he was as much not there as there. But she was very fond of him. He was very fond of her, but they were not really... They were semi-detached. But then, as they married each other with the intention of being semi-detached, this was not too bad.
It wasn't an evolution towards being semi-detached. They were semi-detached from the start.
Yes, but not in the same way, of course. I mean, if you're in love, building a family, you're slightly different from when you're settled. But they certainly never had the remotest quarrels. Never.
Yes, when I said that her family...
But it was the family. It was... It was very important, but it wasn't the traditional family based on an equal set of parents with children. Because she was both father and mother. It was a slightly curious family group, but it was a very successful one.
By family, I really meant the straight Amelia, really, and Mudhouse, and you.
Sure. But you can't entirely leave out the fact that it was an untypical husband bride.
No, no. Which didn't worry her at all.
Not at all. At least I don't think so. And I think she found a lot of what the companionship part of marriage, which she didn't get to a great extent, because Oliver was always somewhere else. Except, as I say, on these rare occasions when he turned up, she got very largely out of Pippa, you see. And there she got what she would have perhaps found more difficult to accept in a male. She found very much the same strange characteristics and companionship in Pippa.
Pippa got on well, presumably, with Oliver, as they all got on well with each other, didn't they?
They did, but they all, among those 10 brothers and sisters, they paired off a bit. And Pippa was Lytton's pair, and Pearl was Oliver's pair, really. Oh, but they were all fond of each other, but they did specialise slightly. And Pippa and Lytton were the two that were really very close indeed. That's what Christopher and I were too, because we didn't got much choice.
I think Saunders says in the book that Lady Strachey had an almost deliberate policy of pairing an older one with a younger one.
Well, it worked. They stuck that way all through life.
Yes. Yes. There's one other thing I think about. I just...
Because of her admiration for Lord Robert, which was enormous. He was one of the great charismatic figures in her life. She adored him. Thought he was a saint. And I think she got swept up very much in his wake. And she went across America with him and with the Noah Baker. And I think it was the sort of the impetus given by this excitement. It was almost a kind of professional falling in love with that. I mean, she didn't fall in love with him at all. I mean, he was not the kind of person who did. But she got lit up by him, totally lit up. And I think this carried on for a bit. But he, after all, got a bit disillusioned too, didn't he? I mean, the whole thing came to bits in his hand. And I think she, the, she, Then there was this fascinating bit about Liberia, which was great fun.
Yes, yes.
And she got very caught up in that, and that was still League of Nations stuff. But after that, it folded. I mean, it wasn't she who left it, it was it who left her.
Is there any connection between her and the Lisson family at all? I mean, there is a connection earlier on, of course, in the Strait Chief family, isn't there? But does she have any connection with the Lisson family?
The only thing I can tell you about the connection with the Lisson family is that she always said that if she had had her choice, she would have married off her two children. The son would have married Gwen Reverell, the one who wrote Period Peace. Now, her daughter, actually. She got a daughter called, I think, Susan Reverell. And that I ought to have married one of the Lytton family. This was what she would have regarded as being genetically desirable. That's as far as I can get on. I didn't oblige, neither did Christopher.
Her grandmother is another major figure. Now, was that self-conscious? Did she say, great-grandmother would have said, or said this, that, and the other all the time, or was it something that simply was bred into her? She simply absorbed her grandmother's tactics for dealing with situations, wisdom, what it like.
It was both conscious and unconscious. It was certainly conscious. She wrote a book about it. And, we were quite deliberately taught the same rules. Quite deliberately. But it was also unconscious. She couldn't help it because she was the nature of the beast. But we knew that this was coming straight from Hannah.
And what comes from Hannah is a source of wisdom as to the ways of the world, in a sense. Is it
kind of ease of human relationships? The prime thing that we were taught, and even that I later learned to quarrel with, but the prime statements which we learned from her was, the first thing is, in no conceivable circumstances do you take umbrage. Never. This is the silliest thing that a human being can do, and that we don't take umbrage. And if you take offence, you've negatived all the benefits of the thing which you were taking offence about. That was the first one. And the second one was, is you don't get jealous. You get as much affection as you deserve. And if you get less, be nicer. That was the other one. That was the other one. Those were the two kind of cardinal points that we were told. They're fairly valuable points.
They're absolutely central to the avoidance of the sort of sectarian battles that go on in public life.
I think they're fairly valuable.
I've
certainly got no quarrel with having been taught them.
No. The trouble with the women's movement, particularly, I think, in this period, is that there are so many...
All this business of little battles between people,
yes,
and little people saying, this is my field, and you keep off it, and
yes.
Taking
Yes. And she...
Never.
Did she ever sort of talk about the feminist world in these terms? I probably wouldn't remember if she did, would you? Because you weren't interested in that area particularly. Did she see herself as...
Well, she'd laugh at it, you see. I mean, she'd sometimes tell us of some of the fiendish battles that went on between these people, but as something slightly ridiculous and to be mocked, and something which, mercifully, she hadn't been... She didn't suffer from it. It was a disease, you see. You didn't suffer from it, you're lucky.
And your family admired and all that, in a sense, enabled you to get away from it.
And also that, I mean, she wasn't capable of taking up, because, I mean, this was something which had been really bred out of her early childhood. You don't do it. And she didn't. It's like losing your temper. You don't lose your temper either. You don't lose your temper. You don't take up and you're not jealous. You don't expect more affection than you get.
And if you've got all those attitudes, how the hell do you get on so well with Lady Astor?
Just because you don't. She
yes.
Must find it very restful. She must have.
You had a marvelous anecdote, really, I suppose it is an anecdote almost your last memory of your mother.
At
Bedford College.
Bedford College. They lived in Bedford. Actually, my father was a governor of Bedford College, and so was Pippa, so that we had a sort of prescriptive right to the place. But the... beginning of the war, it was the women's service occupied the Bedford College. Oddly enough, the very room, or I seem to remember the very same room, if it wasn't that one, it was the next door one, in Bedford College, which my mother used to live in. I had an office in a little later when it became BBC, which there she was living in Bedford College. And virtually the day before she went into hospital, I went to visit her, met her at the garden. And it had one of those long corridors with rooms opening off it and only a door right in the middle of it. And she couldn't be bothered to go all the way down to the door and then into the corridor and then all the way back again to go into the room. She said, oh, can't be bothered with that, let's climb in. So she climbed in through the window, the ground floor window, and almost the last I could see of her then was a huge behind vanishing through the ground floor window.
Wonderful sight. Typical too. Sort of unpretentious, spontaneous, natural.
And large.
We talked about personal service, but I'd rather like to stop there because it makes an artistic ending. But secretaries, what sort of help did she, secretarial help did she have throughout her career? Can you?
Well, I don't know quite how often she had it, but certainly for a long time she had a secretary called Miss George, and I think she was part-time. She was certainly part-time some of the time. But how often she had her, I really cannot tell you. But she used to use a secretary for writing her letters and for coping with things. She typed. I mean, she typed herself and she typed all her talks and things. But she did use a secretary for correspondence a lot. But I don't think she was ever full-time.
And that secretary was paid out of her own money or out of her mother's money.
Yeah.
And she'd also presumably have secretaries at her various professional.
Well, when she was at Lady Astor's and when she was in the Women's Employment Federation, there was probably secretarial assistance. But this was when she was more or less freelancing. And when she was, obviously the Women's Service wouldn't have scope for having as much as a secretary for one person, or even for part-time, I should have thought. I mean, they were not really very well funded.
No. I'd love to get in, you know, on the inside picture of how the Women's Employment Federation worked, because if
anybody left?
Well, I was going to say, if Irene Hilton is alive, I would certainly like to go and see her.
It was never very big, of course.
No. But then, in a sense, the market has to cater for us, isn't big either.
So what I mean, there's not much choice.
Mm-hmm. But
it's certainly not in the telephone book, you